Coming to Gary in Iowa in 3, 2, 1, you're on the air.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Gary and Kenny Show. I'm Gary Kroger, coming to you from Waterloo, Iowa. I forgot for a moment. Mm-hmm. And I am joined, as always, by Kenneth Seisler in the land of pumpkins.
That would be me.
That would be Calabasas. Kenny, how are you?
I'm good. Yeah, everything's great. I don't have any, you know.
Why do you knit your brow when you say you're good?
That wasn't sincere. You know, when people ask me the question, I like to be a little sincere. I'm just
that's
casual.
Not sincere. That's angry.
No, that wasn't angry. That was thinking of whether or not.
So when you think,
so when
you
I answer
sort of
you, what you get a sincere, real answer of
okay,
how
Kenny,
I am.
Kenny, how are you?
Well, now I'm a little annoyed.
Ken, look, I always say we have a special guest. Of course, all of our guests are special, but they're not usually in Budapest, Hungary. We have someone on the line from Budapest, Hungary.
Budapest, are you there? Can you hear us, Budapest?
What I'm trying to say, Kenny, is usually we have our little shoot the shit 10 minutes. Let's cut the shit and go right to guest.
Let's go.
What do you say?
I say, ladies and gentlemen, Gary's introduction.
We have a great guest today, live from Budapest, Hungary. That's the first time that I've ever said that on the Gary and Kenny Show. Kirk Ward is very hard to categorize because he used to be a stand-up. He's a writer. He's an executive producer. He's an actor. He's a comedian. He's a showrunner. His shows include Wayne. He was with Culture Clash when I first got to know who he was. He's currently in Budapest, Hungary, shooting, where he's the executive producer and showrunner, The Continental, which is sort of a, I guess you'd call it a prequel to the John Wick series. So I know you're going to want to hear about this. There's so many things. He's from Hollister, California, but let's just bring him on. Oud Vodeselak.
Wow.
Kirk Ward, how about that?
This is also not only a first for Hungary, but what a reunion for me and Kirko. That was many years ago, Kirko.
Yeah, so just first real of all, quickly. Gary. Thank you for that intro, Gary. I can't just slide that by. I've never gotten one of those before.
Really?
Yes.
Sorry to interrupt you. I didn't know that you had never gotten an intro like that.
I had a moment.
You're somewhat verklempt.
Would you like to do? He can do it again, Kirk.
No. I want to.
And that was please welcome in my best Hungarian.
I was just going to tell how I know Kirko. We did a show together called Culture Clash, which I'm very proud of. Great show. Anyhow, they're a Latino or Chicano comedy troupe. And
we've had Herbert on the show.
And with the boys, when we got the boys together to do the show Culture Clash, they brought along the white guy. Because in all their sketches, there was always the need for a white guy. All right, where do we put the white guy? I'll put the bike. Have the white guy sit over there. Okay, let's have the white guy. Am I right, Kirko?
And I remember, Kenny, you and Joe Ravello not so hot on the kid from Hollister at first.
Really? Drill down.
Looking for three Mexicans. We weren't looking for the extra white guy.
Were they rude?
No, but I remember now I get it as a producer because this guy shows up and he's this intern writer friend of theirs that's done.
Did you get any money?
And I remember they wanted me to do President Clinton on the first show. And I could overhear Kenny in the office going, but he's like, what is this guy, 20 something years old? I can get a Clinton impersonator anyway. I got the dime a dozen.
Yeah,
and then I remember I was sitting in my office and Kenny appeared in the doorway and he goes, so when you do your Clinton, we might have a backup in case things don't go well. And I was like, oh my God. And Steve Higgins, you remember Steve Higgins?
Yeah, we had him on the show too.
Incredible.
Oh no, we had Dave, right?
We have Dave.
Yeah.
And so I'm sitting in this office. I don't understand how Hollywood works. I barely understand how it works now. And I'm like, well, you know, like kind of like complaining with like Steve, like, and Steve Higgins is like, well, you know, just don't fuck up. You'll be fine.
Now, so people know Steve Higgins has been the head writer for Saturday Night Live for now.
Yeah,
I don't know.
And
how many
Steve's years. Still the same way. And Kenny is still the same way. Kenny, you tend to doubt that anything's going to work. And you
I will say this as far as working. I know my wife said, don't bring this up because you're going to sound old. But I find it amazing that we are having an international video call from in Budapest, Hungary right now. And it's not costing us. Is it costing you money? Who's paying for this?
No, nobody's paying for this. And there's no like time satellite lapse or anything.
It's unbelievable.
Well, before we get into your past, let's get into where you are right now. Why are you in Budapest? And you're like 150 miles from Ukraine. Talk about that.
Yeah, we had to have the FBI agent that works with Lionsgate, and apparently when there's a war on your doorstep, you learn that studios have FBI consultants that they work with for security. So he flew over here and talked about possible evacuations, and they put me in charge of a satellite phone.
Oh, right, yeah.
And just today I realized, oh, shit, I haven't got that thing up and running yet. I better... There's a manual. And, but no, it's... besides that, which is just horrific with the refugees, it's really... You know, it's a bizarre thing to navigate that, where you're experiencing this so close for the first time in my life. I've never been this close to war, and then you're like, oh, we got a show to make,
right? You know? Yeah, what a remarkable place to be right now, to be shooting a show. Yeah. So, so when did you first start? Well, let's back up. So, your Constantine is for Starz. Let's have you explain it and how it's going to be presented.
The Continental.
The Continental. Yes,
I thought that's what you meant, Kenneth.
That's okay.
I'm going to fix it in post.
No, it was good. Constantine, John,
I actually thought I was wrong all of a sudden, because Constantine makes so much sense, but it's the Continental.
We have adapted the John Wick movie franchise for Starz and Lionsgate. It will premiere on Starz. And it's set in 1975. I don't know if you know the John Wick universe.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Of course.
We are focusing on the Ian McShane character, Winston, the young Winston, and how where he was in the world and how he got pulled back into this hellscape of New York 1975.
And Budapest is playing New York 1975.
Yeah. It's great when it's tax break on paper as
well. Well, is it the tax break? I mean, I know they have a good studio system there, but you had Belgrade at your disposal probably. Why did we settle on Hungary?
I mean, we were about to go, and then COVID hit, and there was this kind of lapse of like, uh-oh. And then we were like, we're not going to shoot in New York. We're going to go to London. Then it was like, no, we can't go to London. Netflix just bought up a bunch of stages. And so we were like, we're going to Budapest. So, look, it does play well. I mean, it's a medieval city, the architecture, and for the John Wick movies kind of have that cool gothic medieval thing, and since we're doing New York 1975, which hasn't been easy, because you have to get American cars, and
I would imagine challenge.
It's a challenge, but they have an amazing, like, they were really getting it together over here, because
good technicians, don't they? I mean, they have very good lighting and very good camera people.
And very blue collar. They're very blasé.
The language hasn't been a problem?
Well, no, but what I love is when they meet you, they're like, nice to meet you. Mm. And then once they know that you respect them and they respect what you're doing, and then it's like they're all in. There was never like, this is a problem. There's language barrier, which can slow things down when you're trying to, because, this is a $100 million show at the end of the day with two units and tons of action and stunts and people flying out windows.
Do you have to have a certain percentage of Hungarian actors? What's the percentage of Americans that you brought over?
I'm not that smart. I don't know, but we didn't bring many Americans over, just our main cast. We're primarily casting for smaller roles out of London, and then casting as many locals as we can.
Mel Gibson is part of your cast, right?
Yes.
Has he been there the whole time?
He is pretty staggered. He's playing a villain, and You never know what you're going to get when an A-lister that's been in the game for 50 years shows up, and somebody like Mel, who's had his struggles, and I'm not judging that. But he has hit the ground running, and he's just...
He's a total professional, right?
Well, the other thing I would think would be intimidating, even if I was directing him, is he's a filmmaker. I mean, It's not like he's just an actor. He's looking around, seeing what you're doing.
He really, yeah, and he's very, very smart. And that's the part that was intimidating. Because to me, he's Martin Riggs, right? He's my favorite action movie. He's Martin Riggs.
He's going to direct, right?
No.
The next installment?
So the first day, he's on set. And, nice talking to everybody. And then the director comes over and says, Mel has some questions for you about the script. And as I'm walking over there, I'm like, wait, I've got to talk to the road warrior. Like, I'm a kid from Hollister, California. I'm a 3-time junior college dropout. I don't even know how I got here. And he's like, yeah, so let's talk about the, and he's like, he's talking about the scene. And so he's here and I'm here and I'm just like, I've got my script and I'm just like,
yeah.
And it was great, but it was going, he's all about the text and all about the character when he's in acting mode.
No, I think he's brilliant. It's been hard for me as a huge Mel Gibson fan to watch the incidents from the past. And I know he's still very defensive about it. And he's still in the news. They want to compare Will Smith to him now in American press.
No, you can tell this man has done a tremendous amount of work and soul searching within himself. He's very honest about what he went through, where he came from, and polite and kind to everybody. I mean, genuinely, like I was watching him and like talking to the extras, talking to the crew. And then you get to see, like you were saying, Kenny, the director brain where it was a long day. It was the end of the day. And so we're doing 3 movies, right? Like old school movie of the week. So we're not doing 10 episodes. So we have Albert Hughes of the Hughes Brothers, formerly of Hughes Brothers, is directing our first and third movie. And then we have a director middling. And she was trying to figure out the scene. And I was cast as a featured henchman. That's why I have my...
Hench hair.
He's been a henchman in many.
I showed up and the director's like, oh, you're playing this Scottish henchman, right? Here I am, the showrunner, and I'm standing next to Mel Gibson as like a featured extra in the scene, and it's unbelievable, and it's a long day, and he's really crushing it. I mean, to watch him work and then watch the playback, you just go like, how in the fuck does somebody do this? But it was, the director walks up and she's trying to get this shot, and he politely says, and I'll never forget this, so I'm Mel Gibson, there's a techno crane techno looming over, and then the actress and I are off to the side of the techno, right? And they're trying to figure out the shot and how to get the gold coin in, and Mel says, if I may, if you're trying to get me and the coin in the same shot, you should pull the techno back, widen your focus, and then he had some reference about a 220 lens, which is over my focus.
Right.
And then, but it was so respectful. He goes, and then Katie, don't jump the line. Go behind the camera. I'll use her eyeline. Kirk, you just fill in next to the techno, and then I'll. And everyone just looked at each other, and they were like, okay. And then Mel looks at me and goes, I've done this before.
That's amazing.
That's delightful. That's great. You must have a very good atmosphere on your set.
It was incredible. But my favorite little moment was action, right? We set it all up. Actress says her line. She crosses behind. He's following her eye line. I step in. He's still over here acting with her. And out of frame with his finger, he's going like this to me to get closer to the techno for his eye line. And then he turns and I was just like,
wow.
And you know, it wasn't like I did. It was like cut, and everyone was just like, "Man, I mean, he just gives."
I got to tell you, I mean, because I never, you know, every time his name comes up, you know, it brings up all of this stuff and debate and whatever. And I got hearing this story kind of sounds like this guy has a new perspective on life, and seems terrific.
I don't know him very well. Like, I'm not
right, but you can see his behavior.
But yeah, I genuinely, like, when he would get frustrated. Well, it was not at people. It was like trying to figure out that character and
right.
trying really genuinely into it.
This is huge for me because I just posted something where I was critical of Mel Gibson simply because of his behavioral things. Some things that, you know, are very difficult to get over, and I'm a huge fan. So hearing this actually makes me want to rewire my language. I'm going to go in and apologize a little bit. I am.
Now, you're doing The Continental.
Yeah.
And from it's an element taken out of a movie, which I'm noticing is kind of a trend nowadays.
Yeah.
Is that you'll have these big franchises and then they start to pull a storyline or a character out of it.
Yeah.
Where did go ahead.
Yeah. It's just IP. I mean, I really think it comes from the studios and networks going, this is a big IP and, you know, universe.
But now it's just like pulling out little pieces of it and monetizing every element of it.
And they're doing it also in the John Wick universe. There are the ballerinas from John Wick 3 that you see these ballerinas and they have the same tattoo that John Wick has. And they're in the scene with Angelica Houston. You get a sense that there's some sort of assassin school there. Now the ballerina movie is going to come out.
Right.
John Wick 4 is going to come out. Our show is going to come out. So, you know, what's interesting about John Wick is this was an independent movie in like 2014, right. 2015. I mean, it was a little indie and it's really a unicorn in the sense that, you know, in the middle of like Bourne Identity and all right. the Marvel movies and all this, like suddenly comes this thing that competes with everything and it's not IP. At the current time, it wasn't, and now they're world building out of it. I mean, it's just a thing.
Where did the idea emanate? Who was it that was sitting there and going, you know what would be a good thing? In watching the entire franchise, that hotel.
Yeah. You
know? Who was the one that said that hotel's the place that we should?
The hotel for assassins.
Yeah.
I mean, that obviously that was built into the movie franchise, but mm-hmm. Lionsgate had the idea, let's do this, let's focus on the hotel. And then there was actually a writer's room that was built that I had nothing to do with. My writing partner, Greg Coolidge, and I had nothing to do with. And then that failed. And then Lionsgate, we had adapted the Expendables movie franchise.
Oh, I didn't know.
For Lionsgate for about a year was Sly. We had a premiere date after the Super Bowl 2015. A bunch of politics happened, things fell apart. But when I got that taste of an international action franchise, I was like, oh man, I want to do this. Especially when you start looking at the numbers of like, oh, this is going to premiere in 60 markets. And you start thinking of like, wow, you know, this is to survive in this like feature TV world, this big stream that's happening right now. You really have to chase the projects that are going to make some noise, I believe.
Right. So did you write the script for this one?
Yeah.
Oh,
Expendables, we're ready to go. And then what happened was Kevin Beggs, the president of Lionsgate, who we have a history with, was having lunch with our agent in the real Hollywood way. And he said, hey, we're trying to adapt the John Wick movie franchise into television. Maybe Coolidge and Ward would be interested in doing that. And I was, when I got that call, I'm like, yes. And in my mind, I was like, I'm getting this. I love this franchise. I love action. I'm doing this. And I just, in my mind, had it sent. And then I was in Trader Joe's one day and I ran into this guy who is a big showrunner. And I'm like, what are you doing? We have our baskets, you know, in the frozen. And he's like, oh, I'm working on this adaptation of the John Wick franchise. And I'm like, oh, so am I. He goes, yeah, everyone is, you know. So then we went in and pitched a take, and it was really interesting. Silence in the room. Silence, and the two executives were looking at each other like synchronized swimmers and looking at us. And I literally walked out in the lobby. I'm like, fuck this, man. You know what? Fuck this. You just have those, you know, those days. Then we get a call, and they were like, listen, we want to screen John Wick 3, this is before it come out. We want them to see John Wick 3 because their pitch, they had some alluded to pieces in it. We want to make sure that they come in the right way. And I was like, okay, that's progress. Literally, we went to Lionsgate, had a private screening, and it was as if we had seen the movie and ripped off parts of it to where we were putting it, like we were, it was almost like we did part of the movie.
So you just instinctively understood where it needed to go or where it had been.
Yeah.
That's cool.
And then our turn was, well, fuck, we can't do this in, we can't parallel the John Wick universe. We don't have Keanu. What can we do? Mm-hmm. And then it was like, wait a minute. What if we, in the first movie, Winston says, I've been running this hotel for 40 years, right? And that was, that movie came out in 2015, and those movies take place over the, all four of them take place over the course of like, you know, 8 days or whatever. So I Googled, I was like, I did the math, like New York, you know, 1975, and I Googled New York 1975, and Fear City popped up when New York was in a downward spiral and they were bankrupt, and, you know, the Chancellor of Germany had come over to New York to, you know, beg them not to move the financial institution and the garbage strike. And I was like, oh, we were like, wait a minute. What if we come in this way, right? What if we come in through 1975 and do an origin story and focus on Winston, which will keep us away from Keanu and all of the, you know, the assassin, the way that those characters move and those movies, and the world is so expansive and it's already fully identified. Yeah. So, and then we went in and pitched it. And let me just tell you, it 3 months, 10 pitches. And on the eighth pitch, when we pitched the CEO, John Feltheimer, he actually looked at us and said, why don't you go away and rethink this whole thing? So to make a long story short, it's been 2.5 years to get to this.
Well, when does it come out? You know, when do you get, I see you have a wedding ring. So when do you get to be with your family again?
Yeah, I know. That's been tough.
Stars is going to play it, right?
Yeah. All we know is 2023.
Okay.
That's all we know.
Now does John Wick make any kind of presence through your episodes? Okay.
No, of course, if we were to continue,
right, then he would come into the story.
A really cool way to fold him in.
I got to ask you, Kirk, as actor you, hack actor me, little Kirk Ward in Hollister, California, what is it you wanted to be? Was it an actor? You started in stand-up? Have you figured it out yet?
No,
is there a train that you got on and thought, this is it?
Honest to God, I tell this story a lot to people because it's the truth. I grew up in a, you know, I was obsessed with Chips in second grade, and then I got all that Stephen J. Cannell TV from Magnum P.I. 18, you know, and then Commando and Rambo and then, you know, Die Hard and Lethal Weapon. And I was just obsessed with television and with action and with comedy, just really. But I never was like, oh, I'm going to be an actor. I never thought that. I was a jock. I was a wrestler. I mean, I was a football player. I was captain of the football team.
And Hollister, if I'm not correct, isn't that the site of the motorcycle rallies?
Yes.
Really.
Like a Sturgis kind of thing?
No.
What was the movie? The Wild Boys?
The Wild Ones?
The Wild Ones. It's kind of suggested.
That's Hollister. Yeah, it is Hollister, isn't it?
Yeah. In the 50s, they took it over. My grandfather always told the story of, they destroyed my lawn. I had to go out there with the shotgun.
Sounds like me today.
I didn't know what I wanted. You know, I was 16 and I was a horrible student. And I went to the counselor.
Let that be a lesson to all the kids out there.
I mean, I was a horrible student. I didn't. And I also, I know I have some kind of something of ADD or dyslexic. I mean, I just didn't pay. I didn't know what was going on in school. And so when I found I could make people laugh, I was like, oh, well, there's my way into everything. And then I was sitting in Mrs. Brown's she was a counselor, and
of course,
she was putting my classes together for next year, for my junior year. And she said, "What about an acting class?" And no one ever said that. I went, "Well, what do you do in acting class?" She's like, "Oh, they do this." And I'm like, "That sounds like shop class without tools. I'm in."
And you know that every counselor who says that has given up on you.
Yes,
that's when they go, "How about acting? Because at least it keeps you occupied."
And then And then by the grace of some higher power, Pete Lavorato, who was a famous football player in Canada, you can look him up. He was seven Grey Cups with the Edmonton Eskimos, and he was on SCTV, and he'd done all this theater, and he was like a guest star on Canadian TV. He came to my small town and was my football coach and theater teacher. And he was like, oh, you're great. I don't even know if I was, but he completely encouraged me. And I would started writing my own scenes to perform in the class. One time I called him on a Sunday. I go, hey, what if I come to class late? And then you and I get in an argument and you throw me out. And he goes, genius. Great. So I walk into class and he's like, hey, you're late. And I'm like, whatever. And he's like, oh, you think you're just because you play, you're a football player that you have some kind of carte blanche here? And then I went too far and I'm like, hey, fuck you, man. And he's like, fuck you. Right? We start screaming. The kids move up against the classroom. I get out of here. And then I come back in 20 minutes later and I'm like, hey, and there's girls are crying, guys were mad. But I really found that I don't know, I knew that I liked something. And then our connection with Kenny, I had gone surfing one night in Santa Cruz and I stopped.
And there was Kenny.
No.
And I stopped by my buddy Seth Millwood's house and he lived out in the Aromas and his dad was like a hippie. And
Santa Cruz is a weird place.
And he says, hey, man, I'm going to go see Culture Clash tonight. And I was like, what's that? And he goes, you don't know. They perform at El Teatro Campesino in San Juan, man. And I was like, all right, I'll go. I had no idea. And I went to Luis Valdez, who, you know, Zoot Suit La Bamba. He had this theater outside of Hollister. And I sat in that theater that night. And it wasn't like, oh, my God, this is what I want to do. But I just was in awe that people could do this. They did this. They were grown men doing songs and raps and brilliant layered comedy.
Relevant.
Yeah.
Political.
I was just, because I love Saturday Night Live, and then I was just obsessed with them, and I kind of stalked them. Like,
just. Well, the thing is, you said you didn't really know what was going on with Culture Clash. The reason that I didn't really know who you were was because I don't think the boys really knew who you were. You were just kind of always there, and we just kept going, okay, the white guy.
Yeah.
And you joined Timothy Robbins' company somewhere in there too, right?
Yeah, and then so I did. So I was living in San Francisco, and Richard Montoya called me and said, hey, man, we're doing a show in L.A., do you want to be in it? And I'm like, yes. And they said, we need 5 bales of hay. And that's really why they wanted me to be in the show. So I think I know that sketch. Yes. I drove to my hometown of Hollister. I was living in a tool shed in San Francisco, broke, no money, just doing theater. I walked in my front door and my mom said, what are you doing home? I said, I'm moving to LA. She said, when? I said, tonight. She goes, oh, okay. Well, do you have a place to stay? I said, no. So she gives me like $80 out of her wallet. I call my friend Donnie Marcus, who has hay. I drive up to his ranch. Hey, I just knew. I was like, this is an opportunity. And I drove all the way to LA all night, pulled up in front of Herbert's place, waited for him to come outside, went to the theater. We started. Then I slept in my truck. I slept in my truck the first night, slept in my truck the second night. And then Rick, who's very perceptive and caring, goes, hey, where are you staying? I was like, oh, I don't have a place. And then it was just this moment of like, oh, fuck, we didn't think this through. Yeah. And then I moved in with Rick. And then that's the show that Kenny came to with, I believe, Joe Rivella.
Yeah, it probably was. Yeah.
And then that became the Culture Clash.
You are a living testimonial to not making a plan. Just kind of ride the wave.
Well, here's the question, Kirk. When were you able to not do any other work but in show business? When was the first real paying gig that you went, okay, I don't have to worry about it anymore. I got a job.
When my first paycheck was you.
Couldn't have been much.
No, I mean, I was making $350 bucks a week as a writing assistant. Okay. Then I became a writer, and then I became a featured player And then season two, you kicked me up to double scale. So I was like,
double scale.
I'm fucking rich.
What year is that? What year? Put a year. I like to have years on things.
93 to 94.
Well, how did you get Zombieland?
Well, what happened was I got cast in a show called Invasion Iowa.
I'm in Iowa. I'm in Iowa right now.
You are.
I recall the invasion, of course. A black person came over the Mississippi.
It's shot in Riverside, Iowa. It was William Shatner, and the guys that created it, when the show was done, they said, "Hey, we wrote something for you. It's called Zombieland." They gave me the script, and I was like, "Oh my God, this is gonna be incredible." And the script was brilliant, and they were like, "You're Tallahassee. It's gonna be great. It's gonna be great. It's gonna be Woody Harrelson." And I was like,
"You were familiar with the Zombieland 1 and Zombieland 2.
Yeah, no, I was. They had created the character of Tallahassee for me.
For you.
Oh.
Yes.
Oh. Yes. This was before the movies.
Before the movie, right. We're in the 90s.
Yeah, you can look it up online where Rhett Reese and Paul Wernick were like, "No, it was written for me."
Isn't that interesting?
So I remember going to the theater to see Woody Harrelson, who was just incredible in the movie. And I was like, wow. And then years later, you know, I had hit right around 39. I couldn't get arrested again. And I was going to have a baby. And I moved to a house in Pasadena. And, you know, my wife was working a lot. And I was like, I got to change the game. So I really was like, I'm not going to act anymore. I'm just going to write. And so I was fortunate enough to team up with this writer, Greg Coolidge, who had basically was like, "Be my writing partner." And he was with CAA and had tons of success. So like everything in my life, I stumbled into this thing. And then Reese and Wernick called me and were like, "Hey, we're doing Zombieland as a TV show. Do you want to audition?" I'm like, I said, "Look, I have PTSD with acting. I'm done. I could never really get over the hump." And you hit that place where I was 39, I was in an audition, I had a baby on the way, and I was 40, I had a baby on the way, and I'm in a commercial audition, and there's a guy there with a baby who looked like, you know, he'd just fallen off a fucking building and into a suit. He was like rocking the baby and just like, he looks at me and goes, "Hey, can you hold my baby?" Oh, and he gives me his baby and he goes into the audition. I'm like, no one's holding my baby, and I don't even have a baby yet.
Wow.
So I was like, I'm done. And I quit. And that was like a sad time of my life. Cause I was like, oh, I always thought I was going to be on talk shows, you know, telling fucking stories. I just like,
well, you are now. So that dream is accomplished.
I'm here. and then they called me and said, "Hey, do you want to audition for this song?" And I go, no, I don't. And this is the first time I learned that if you actually pass on something and mean it 100%, that they keep coming after you.
Because they always want what they can't have.
The big picture syndrome. Remember the big picture?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Kevin Bacon and Martin Short.
Martin Short, that's right.
And so six or seven phone calls. I was like, no, I don't want to do this. Because I didn't want to go through the process and get kicked in the fucking teeth again. I was like, I can't do this. I can't do it anymore.
Well, if they wrote, I'm going to just go back one question just to go. Did they give you the opportunity to audition for the film, or just they knew they were going to get
it? No, it went right.
They went right. Okay.
I got it. I was like,
you got it. It wasn't like, oh, it hurt that you didn't get that.
But it was a weird, you know, it was like a story I would bring up occasionally, and people would look at me like, "Are you sure that was created for you?"
Yeah.
But then my wife said, "You know what? What do you got to lose? Just do it." And I go, "No." And then they called me and said, "We'll make you a deal. You come to the test. We'll put you in with the three actors that are testing. You're freed. If you get it, you get it, you know." And I go, "All right, fuck it. You know, like, one audition. It's a test. I get to go." And I had already not gotten it. And I'm not great at auditioning. I know that actors say that a lot. And I mean, I'm really not. And so I go to this audition. I walk in at Sony. And it's classic. You know, it's like, "Jason Lee, all these guys, and I'm like, and then fucking Kirk from Hollister, right? And they're like, oh, your turn, Kirk. And I walk in, and, you know, you've been in network tests, right? It's like the theater of people, and the actor that's playing the kid is on the stage, and I walk up and say something dumb, and I got my script, and I've never done this before, and this is a true story, and I'm like, all right, here we go, right? And I read, and as I'm reading, I'm feeling like this is what it sounds like I'm saying the words, and yeah. I'm talking, yeah. And it just sounds fucking stupid, and I went, hang on a second, and I threw the script down, swear my life, and I go, let's go. And I did the thing, and I improvised, and I fought my way through it, and then they were laughing, and then they were like, okay, we want to see you improvise. Here's this and this, and I just went crazy. Wow. And then they said, can you do something emotional? And I was emotional because they wanted to see me, like, grounded. And one of the producers had said, if you get the opportunity to turn on the waterworks, they love that. Mm. Because I was in this space of like what I was going through in my life and in this moment that it was going well, I read this scene with this kid and I just started crying, like tears. And so, but I still thought, I was just like, hey, I finally did good at a test. Like, that's how I was feeling. No lie. I said, thank you very much. These guys are great. You're going to make a great show. It's going to be wonderful. And I walked out of the theater like joking around. Get back to my little office, and I'm writing my at Sunset Gower Studios, writing my script, and you're leaving for Atlanta tomorrow morning. And I was like, what? So I did the pilot. It's through the roof, press everywhere. It's Amazon's new model. I get a call like, hey, can you come to this press thing on Monday? This network called me. My lawyers and agent called me and said, you got to find a house in Atlanta. So my wife and I are like, packing up our lives, you know, classic story. And then I get a phone call Friday at 3:30. I'll never forget. And the producers were like, they're not picking us up at the last second.
Well, I wanted to talk about this because what I read was, I think it got like 100% rating or whatever on critic. All the critics loved it. But Amazon at the time was doing this thing like the audience gets to decide.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what happened, right?
Yes. Which I did another pilot that I wrote and produced at Amazon. And you realize that really isn't how it works, right? Amazon really looks at their TV model as an advertisement for their products, right? Mm-hmm. So they want to tell you that they're invested. Like you're making the choice. And then people sign up for Amazon and they, right, and the algorithm explodes and they say, oh, look at Kenny Seisler is this age. He logged on to watch this. He wrote a review. It ties into his account. Let's see what he's buying, right? So it's not, it wasn't that. And that
wasn't it that Amazon said, did like a poll of whether or not people wanted it to continue? Well,
it sounds a bit like Wayne. Now, Wayne has a lot of fans, including my son, who the concept of a young, angry, you know, near homicidal kid is very appealing. Yeah. So, but wasn't that a similar situation where you were on YouTube, right? Streaming, Amazon picks you. Tell the story there, because there's a lot of Wayne sites here that we'll connect to.
That was a phenomenon. I mean, that was just something that exploded. And you know, it was an incredible experience because to do 10 episodes where a network that was, you know, a little offbeat, their YouTube, they're not, it wasn't like the regular kind of corporate kind of studio system. They kind of let us do what we wanted to do.
Hmm. There's still a lot of fan base for that show, isn't there?
Yeah.
An unbelievable amount of fans. And then it went, and then it didn't get picked up.
Which, again, was, it got great reviews. I watched a few episodes. I thought it was really lovely.
Really good.
Yeah.
I mean, the amount of views that we got on YouTube, you know, in the millions, and the reviews, the positive, and the press combined with Amazon, I'm like, well, this is going to go for a second season. And and nothing. Well,
there's still rumors that it's people are waiting for the next season. Yeah. It's just not going to happen. Is that?
I don't think it's. I mean, you never know. But
now, yeah. Talking about fanboys, now the John Wick, I imagine there's a lot. There's a whole community of John Wickers out there. Yeah. Are they like excited about this project? Are they like? Are they these fan sites where they're telling you what they should do and how you should do it?
Yeah, I don't know, because I honestly like it's intimidating because we're never going to please them. You know, the root of adaptation is change, and therefore, when you change something that someone likes, or we're asked as humans to change something, there's always a resistance.
Yeah, sure.
But they're going to have. I mean, look. The cool thing is Chad Stahelski, who director of the movies, is an executive producer on that, and he has, you know, given the blessing of what we're trying to do. He was very involved, and then he picked the director Albert Hughes and said, "Look, make it your own." Thunder Road, who produces all the John Wick movies, Erica Lee and Basil Iwanek are producers on this, and like, you know, watching cuts and giving notes, and they love it and they're all in. So I think, look, I'm very nervous about the fact, I want the fans to embrace it, but I'm also bracing myself for the fact that, you know, they're fans, and they're going to now look at their world.
Yes,
that's right.
In a different way.
I see big things for you.
Thank you.
In my crystal ball, my Hungarian crystal ball.
Can we talk about Hungary for a second?
Yeah.
Thank you. He's in Budapest. Did you know that, Gary, that when you go to
Budapest actually is how we
Budapest,
say it.
There it is.
Oh, that's pretty. That's pretty.
Hey, that looks nice. Are you on the river?
Here's the question, Kirk.
On the river, yes.
Are you on the Buddha side or are you on the Pest side?
I'm Buddha.
Did you know, Gary, that when you go to Budapest and you get in the car, the guy goes, Buddha or Pest?
Yeah,
you never knew that.
Yeah.
I've been there.
Oh, okay. Well, that's
I've been
how
there.
I
when
it
I made, we won't go into me, but I made a movie years ago in the former Yugoslavia and Belgrade, Zagreb, and all these places. And on days off, you know, Hungary's right there. You get in you got into a Yugo, drove over the border. And it's beautiful. It's absolutely stunningly beautiful.
I don't know of any other city that you think of it as one name. It's not like St. Louis. You're either on the Saint side or the Louis side.
Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania.
Really? Well, no, that's got a hyphen. This is one word,
right.
Budapest.
Yeah, okay. All right. Oh, yeah, you are.
I'm Hungarian.
That's right.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm Hungarian, and I went there, and the first thing I asked for was, "Can I have some Hungarian goulash?"
Hmm.
Do you know that they don't know? They never heard of Hungarian goulash. They looked at me like, "What the hell is Hungarian?"
Like goulash? Italians and pizza.
Maybe my mother made Hungarian goulash, which was just a lot of stuff in it.
We were filming last year. And I mean, the Hungarians, the Europeans, the Central Europeans, are tough people. These are tough people. It's 10 below and they're just outside like, you know, and I'm in my tent with my heater, and, you know, and I walked by this grip truck. It was the most beautiful thing. And there's like this iron cast bowl with this fire underneath and they're making goulash.
Oh, they did. See, that's where I'd have to go, probably to
you know, I feel like if I was in the United States and I walked by that, I'd go, ooh.
Right.
And like, it was like this most beautiful silent moment where they're like, you know,
it's warm. Yeah, it's warm.
And we're standing there and I'm eating thing and literally like tears in my eyes. Like this is, and it's just silence, just the crackling fire. And, you know, you hear the movie being made, you know, 100 yards away and you're just eating goulash with them. And
I got to tell you, I mean, just those Eastern Europeans, look at the Ukrainians, how tough they're exhibiting themselves to be right now. He talks, you know, the Hungarians, they just weather the storms and everything that comes at them. And I mean, Americans, we can't, you know, it's like we were on drizzle alert 2 weeks ago in LA.
Well, we Iowans are a little tougher
you
than
guys are, yes.
Calabasians.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, but anyhow, so Kirko, this sounds phenomenal. I mean, you sounds like you're having some fun. You work with Mel.
Yeah, we have a great cast. I mean, beyond Mel, I mean, we stellar cast.
Kirk, you are still a young man. You are in the midst of really an impressive career. I mean, it's Yeah, you can be modest because you're a genuinely kind and modest guy. I get it. But you're enormously, you have skills that are really baffling, that you can write, that you can produce, that you can act, and you're funny and all that.
I thought it was baffling when he was on our show.
Yeah, well, and I watched, you could really ham it up too. I saw facial expressions like this.
Oh, no, that was me. I was.
Yeah. Oh, I was impressed.
Jim Carrey was having success right next door. Remember, Kenny?
That's right.
That's right. Live in color.
And so I was like, well, it's working for that white guy, so I'll just, you know.
You did it well. Yeah, so my question is obvious because it's like 4 a.m. for you. What's next? I mean, do you have the man with no plans who seems to fall into this wonderful career? Yeah. What's the future after this production look like?
You know, it's weird. I was home. My mother, amazing lady of 87 years, passed away last year.
Sorry.
Yeah, wonderful. But just like, I just want to tell this brief story, if I may.
Please, absolutely.
On her deathbed.
By the way, this is free. So we'll go as long as we want.
On my mother, Patricia's deathbed, raised 5 kids by herself, slept on the couch. Her house had burned down 3 months before she got cancer. I'm with her sitting there. I'm taking care of her. My wife and kids were like, go be, you know, we'll come back and forth to Northern California to Hollister. I'm with my mom. She's very proud that I'm going to do this show, right? And I'm sitting on the edge of her bed, and she goes, and I have a picture over here. This is my mom giving the double bird. She's on my...
Oh, you wait. See that? Yeah, I can.
I see it.
Yeah. She's on my studio pass. She can come with me. Anyways.
Well, send me that picture anyhow. I'll put it up so we can read it.
That'd be great.
Yeah, I will. And so she says, come here, right? So I lean over the bed and she goes, when do you go to the Middle East? Right. She just thought Budapest was the Middle East, right? Mm-hmm. And I go, I don't know, you know. And she knew what she meant. I was waiting for her to pass.
Right.
She just could feel it. And then she goes, and she grabs my collar and she pulls me closer and she goes, don't you fuck this job up because of me.
Wow.
Yeah. And it was just like, boom. And it hit me. And then when my mom passed, the point of my story of what's next is I'm with my family and I'm telling the story and they say, And then after this, like, what's your next show? And I'm like, I don't have a job. I don't have anything lined up.
Like, well, but if history repeats itself, Kirko.
Yeah, but I mean,
you're going to be in a garage someplace.
Yeah. No, I will have more opportunities.
Did you put something away? Did you put a little something away?
No, it's like, my point is, you know, you can plan and I can prepare, you know, in the circus that we're in, you can go, yeah, this is what I want. And then it doesn't happen or it happens. Or, I mean, what's fun about this is I was on with my agents the other night and it was like, oh, this was a cool phone call because they were like, hey, you're coming back and so and so wants to meet you and this person and they're looking for this. And I was like, oh, wow. At in my early 50s, I've been waiting for this moment where I'm not in fear of lack of security, you know?
Mm-hmm. No.
Because most of my life since I was, and you know, you guys don't know this fun fact, Comic Strip Live, Wayne Cotter, that's when I got into stand-up was because of that show. And I told you the story, Kenny, and I used to, since I was 19, when I went out on my first stage, I would just rip jokes off from your show, from different comedians and rewrite them. But when that journey started for me at 19 until now, I've never, ever known how I'm going to make it. Ever. Ever, ever. And it's been like I hope that I have more opportunities, but it's always been a thing for me where I'm like, well, I'm broke. You know, and I'll go 5-6 months.
Well, the thing is, have you gotten to the point where you're confident in your talent? Because I know for a long time, for me personally, it was like, I always feel like I fooled him again.
I have this thing.
Imposter syndrome. That's what I have.
Yeah, my version of it is seize him, where I always feel like I'm at work and it's like someone's going to come and be like, seize him. And they're going to pull up. Or my football coach is going to come in and go, what are you doing? And but I feel like, to completely vulnerable and honest, I never knew what a producer did. I knew what good producers did. Kenny and Joe, I watched them like, oh, they're producers. I've watched producers over the years. But when I started becoming a showrunner, I was like, oh, you know what? I think I really have a thing for producing. And I didn't even realize that it's like, I really enjoy problem solving in production, because outside of a high stakes scenario, right? You put me in my basement office in the Glendale Hills alone, where I've got to come up with something. I'm like, distracted, and I'll figure it out. But I always work hard, but I really thrive in this environment, you know, and I really like to produce. I love turning on my phone in the morning and waking up here and, like, you know, you guys know production. It's like all hell has broken loose. The actor can't come in from London and the visa, you know.
You've got to figure it out.
Well, the other thing, it's social. I mean, the two worlds you live in as a talent is that when you're not on a set working, you're basically by yourself. But then when you're on a set, you got everybody's around you. You have all this activity going on. It's very social, you know, and it's actually a lot of, you get to laugh and stuff. And then all of a sudden it's over and it's like everybody drives home.
I know. Yeah. I know. I always talk about that day where, you know, rap and everyone's happy, right? Mm-hmm. You get in the morning, they put you on the plane and mm-hmm. get you the plane. And it's not like they're taking care of you. They're like, get this motherfucker. Right? And then you fly home and it's over. And that's why it sounds so corny, but every day somebody brings me my lunch. Every day I get a ride somewhere. Every day I know my per diem's coming. Whatever it is, I'm like, God, this is to be making, to be part of making, because I didn't make this thing. John Wick, Keanu Reeves, they made this thing, this particular part. To be part of an action franchise at this level and to be able to participate it and try to elevate it and to be taken serious for it. I mean,
these are 3 1-hour movies, or how long is each episode?
Almost an hour and a half.
Okay. Is there in the ether the conversation of, well, if these do well, this will be, we're going to roll out more. We're going to have more guests. Okay.
I mean, I think that's always the case, right? We know that numbers and money mean, you know, like Dune came out, didn't get great reviews. And before it was even out of the theaters, it was green. Like, you know, I hope, I mean, there's also that fear now of, like, my wife the other night said, well, we're moving to Budapest if this happens, you know, because it's, my son is 9.
Yes.
And my daughter is 11, you know, and my daughter is like, you know, Kenny, you have a daughter.
And now I'm a grandfather.
Oh, my God.
I mean, that's what I keep saying.
I mean, in the pool with your kids.
That's right.
Hey, that didn't even occur to me, though, that if it goes on, you've got a, that's.
Yeah.
Well, at least they say that's, hopefully it's a good problem to have.
Problems. Like, if that's the case, like, again, coming from the sees him place.
Yeah, you find a way to write and sleep during those 15 hours going back and forth, too. Well, you know, it's all so exciting. I mean, I have to tell you honestly, I was very excited to meet you, and I hope that I get a chance to actually, whether it's in Budapest or Los Angeles, get a chance to meet you in person, because I really admire your work.
Oh, man, thank you. No, I'm not used to hearing that, but I thank you.
I know. When you cried at the introduction, it told me that, wow, this is a modest guy, but you've got tremendous work behind you and obviously in front of you. It's
Kenny Seisler. Oh, go ahead. I want to tell one last Kenny story, but go ahead.
Oh, please. Yeah. Kenny Seisler stories are always big here.
Kenny was really good to me when I was on the show, honestly. Like, I felt like he gave me tough love in ways, but he was tough on everybody, but, you know, he didn't take any shit. But we always loved Kenny. We loved hearing his voice. Camera one, go camera two.
Yeah. Gary.
I mean, those were magical days.
They were fun.
But one day, Kenny said, hey, what are you doing for lunch? And I said, I don't know. I mean, I didn't even know when I was on the Culture Clash, I didn't know that for lunch was free. And I didn't know anything. And he said, why don't I take you somewhere for lunch? And I go, oh, I don't usually do that. And Kenny goes, let me take you for your first Hollywood lunch. So we go to the Gower Gulch,
mm-hmm.
right? Then we sit down at the sushi place. And Ken, we walk in and Kenny goes, you like sushi? I didn't know what sushi was.
Okay.
I don't even remember this, Kenny. I had no idea. And so Kenny, he's got the menu and he's like talking to people. Hey, Sizler. Hey, how you doing? He's like, it's like, I'm Kevin.
Sizler,
I'm like,
Kenny Sizler, Kenny Sizler.
Everyone loves Kenny's. Kenny. And I'm looking at this fucking menu like, what the fuck, rolls and
Yellowtail.
Yeah. And so Kenny goes, what do you like? And I go, everything. Kenny orders. Kenny's like, I'm gonna order. You like a yellowtail crab cup with the sushi on the thing? I'm like, oh yeah. He gets the thing, and so the food comes, and now I'm like, do I unwrap the shit?
Right. Wow, well, I had no idea, Kirk.
Sushi was a punchline in a sitcom to me. I didn't even know what it looked like. I didn't know. So Kenny's talking, and you know, he's got the napkin. He's telling, and he's picking up the chopsticks. So I'm just kind of imitating what he's doing, you know. And while he's talking to the table next to us, I go, I'll just start with the guacamole. So I scoop up what I think is guacamole.
My mouth hurts just hearing this.
This much. And I'm like, I've got on the chopsticks, and I'm like, and Kenny's like, all right, Rick, wonderful. He turns around and I put it in my mouth, and he goes, whoa, 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 whoa. Like, and it goes into my mouth, and I'm like, and I fucking freak out. And Kenny's looking at me like I fucking landed. I step out of the kitchen. And he's like, saying to me, he goes, this is a classic Kenny line. He goes, someone get some dairy. Get the kids some milk. Get the kids some milk. Right? So the waiter brings it, like, and it's like 2%, and it's hot. And I'm like, I calm down and like, you know, my eyes and nose, and I'm like,
that is a great story.
And he goes, what the hell are you doing? I go, I've never had sushi before. And it was the sweetest moment, because an asshole would have been like, oh, you Jack. And Kenny goes, well, let me teach you about sushi. And it was just the best moment. We had this It was my first like Hollywood.
What a great story.
Kenny, that's my favorite Kenny story.
And, you know,
ever.
But I just want to say, as you're telling that story, when I grew up, I never heard of sushi in New York. I mean, the first time I heard of sushi was when I came to Los Angeles. So I was somebody, I had probably a very similar incident, although I never would have figured guacamole, because I never heard of guacamole when I was growing up. So I might not. Well, that is hysterical.
Well.
I'd like to see that in a scene from The Continental.
Oh my God.
Actually, that is something to use somewhere.
I tell that story all the time.
Oh, wow.
I love that.
Do you like sushi now, though?
Yeah, oh, I love sushi.
Oh, see, now, of course, right. Now you're a Hollywood. Yeah. One day you're going to take a kid out and you're going to have the exact same thing. Yeah.
And just watch them discover.
Yeah.
Well, Kirk, you made my day. Not only your presence and your stories, but the Kenny story. That's going to be the teaser for this, Kenny. Okay. I want that segment right there that I'm going to just send to everybody. It's going to be my Christmas card.
Well, Kirk, I can't thank you both enough. And Kenny, when I get back, both of you, and Gary, when you fly in from the corn state, I would love to get together. And I mean,
well, there's awesome. No question.
Hey, can we go sushi?
So great.
Can we go sushi? Will you relive that moment?
Yes.
I will.
Gary, it was such a joy to meet you, my man. And Kenny, I love you, dude. Thank you for, you know, I'm really grateful for those days and you kind of jumping me into this town. And the other thing you taught me about Hollywood was, when it came to dating, was women in Hollywood. You go, you got a taste from the smorgasbord. I never really knew what that meant, but I was like, okay.
He still talks that way. Kirk, thank you so much. The best of luck. We're watching. Can't wait to talk to you. Can't wait to see you. Thanks for staying up till 5:30 in the morning. You know,
it's here 10 and, o'clock.
All right, whatever. Thank you, folks, for watching The Gary and Kenny Show. You can find us on our YouTube channel, where we'd love it if you would subscribe to us. We're on all of the podcast platforms, and we're on streaming TV, DBNA TV. Thanks, everyone. See you later.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much.